Hello, and welcome to Unscripted, conversations about sexual and domestic violence, a podcast featuring employees and subject matter experts from domestic and sexual violence services and partner organizations discussing all aspects of interpersonal violence while providing prevention strategies, solutions, and resources for support for residents of Fairfax County. I'm your host, Kendra Lee. On this episode of Unscripted, I'm with Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Advocacy Supervisor Lydia Gerges, Victim Advocate Soojin Kim, and Domestic and Sexual Violence Counselor Jeanette Aliman to talk about the ways we support immigrant survivors of interpersonal violence. Lydia, Soojin, Jeanette, salam, annyeonghaseyo, hola. Welcome to Unscripted and thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. 안녕하세요.
Thank you for having us.
Before we start, I want to let our listeners know if any part of today's conversation triggers strong emotions, please call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. Fairfax County is a very large, very diverse county with immigrant communities that speak more than 140 languages. For those immigrants who have experienced violence, seeking support can come with a unique set of challenges. We'll break down how we support three of these communities on this episode. How is domestic violence or abuse defined in other cultures? This is for all of you to respond to, but Lydia, we're going to start with you.
Definitely. Domestic violence is defined in a very different way in different culture, of course. But when we talk about Arabic-speaking culture, that's a lot of cultures. That's not just one culture. And even though language unify us, that doesn't mean that we all have the same culture. Uh-huh. There is a lot of aspects in domestic violence that's very normalized in our culture. You can see it in the media. You can see it in the way we talk. Physical violence between two partners is very normalized. So everyone sees domestic violence a little bit different based on how they were raised, where they were raised, how their parents treated each other, how, other trauma in their life. So it's really hard to pinpoint what domestic violence specifically means in a specific culture.
Okay, a little more context for this. Domestic and Sexual Violence Services did a series of You Are Not Alone videos during the first year of COVID, and our staff members created videos that said you were not alone, and the staff members that spoke another language did one in English and one in their native tongue. And when we posted these on social media, the one we did in Arabic got a lot of comments, hate comments, thousands of them, more comments than we'd ever had before then and more than we've received since. And they all said pretty much that we're destroying society by talking about this, that we should be ashamed of ourselves for talking about this.
And also there is part of the culture that power and control is not seen as a negative thing. It's seen as a way of a dynamic between two people. And a lot of time in a culture where male dominant is the norm, in some of our culture, it's normalized to have that power and control. So when we look at domestic violence, a lot of times it might not be about power and control because this is something that's expected. When it gets to become toxic, it's when it's, I don't want to say to cross the line because everyone has a different line. But unfortunately, the way that we look at domestic violence from a cultural perspective, it's very specific to which culture you're talking about. And Arabic-speaking countries, there's so many of them. So everyone looks at different aspects of our relationship. If I say that domestic violence in the Arabic-speaking communities is just about power and control, is it? Because that's something that's very, very normal. Is it toxic power and control versus healthy power and control? That's where it comes from.
Okay, we'll break down some of the cultural differences between countries a little later. Jeanette, I want to throw this to you. How do Spanish-speaking communities define or discuss domestic violence?
So just like Lydia mentioned, there are differences, some differences between, you know, we're not very similar. There are very a lot of differences, even when we speak the same language, like South America, Central America, and sometimes when we have people from indigenous communities, you have an additional layer where their Spanish is not even their first language.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have also their own set of values and beliefs. So depending on who you're dealing with in front of you, who you have in your office, or, you know, you cannot come and assume like a treated with like a big blanket, like one size fits all, because, you know, this person in front of me speaks Spanish. There are differences between, you know, South America, Central America, some indigenous communities. And some in general, I would say that violence is against women are sort of normalized. They see it as a right for the male to dominate, to be the one to set the rules, the boundaries, what's allowed, what's not allowed. Of course, that changes depending, you know, sometimes on each family. So it's hard to say it is like one way in general, but there are very a lot of similarities. For instance, I think that religion plays a huge role in Central America. So that's where I'm from, El Salvador. So I can speak more of that, where they view as the role of the male as protector and the head of the family. So to go against that is not viewed as, you know, proper. And the women, even having some in the scriptures, you know, how the women is to submit, even though, you know, they explain it's not submission, but some people take it literally and they, you know, they expect submission and not questioning. And I think it's important to work from where they are, where they come from, and understand their worldview, and not and understand why is it that they're thinking that way. And I usually say, you know, that is not necessarily, those values are not necessarily bad, but do you feel safe now? Does that how is it working for you right now in your relationship? Or, you know, so trying to put it in a different perspective. Like, we're not saying, you know, the way that you're doing it, your community is doing it wrong, but how does it, you know, work for you in terms of, you know, do you feel safe? Do you feel heard? Do you feel, you know, free to express yourself? So that, I know it's a lot, you know, to try to put into a definition, but I would say it's, in general, it's a little bit normalized. And to a certain degree, it's promoted, you know, that the head of the family is the dad, or the male, I'm sorry. And so sometimes it's just seen as, you know, is they even say, oh, it's issues between couples. Nobody should intervene.
Yeah. And Soojin, what about you? How do Korean communities define domestic violence? And I'm particularly interested in your response to this, because I recall a conversation you and I had some time back where you said part of the reason you came to the States to do this work was because nobody was really doing it in South Korea.
Right. The legal definition of domestic violence is very similar as one in the U.S. and other cultures. But in traditional Korean culture, the definition of domestic violence has
historically been much narrower than the comprehensive view we have here. Anything that happened behind the closed doors of a home was considered a private family matter, mm-hmm. not a crime or a social issue. So the physical abuse was often the only thing people might recognize as wrong. But even then, it was often tolerated to maintain family honor and avoid public shame. We call that the 체면. So what we define very clearly here as emotional abuse, verbal abuse, or financial control was simply seen as a part of the husband's patriarchal authority. So the law in South Korea has changed drastically to match a modern definition, but the lingering, the cultural mindset in especially in older immigrant generations, often means these type of abuse are still minimized or ignored as a normal part of marriage.
So what part does family and gender roles and silence about violence play in a survivor reaching out for services?
I think these elements can form a powerful the reinforcing system that makes the reaching out very difficult.
Uh-huh.
The family is prioritized above the individual, leading to immense pressure from in-laws or parents to reconcile rather than leave those situations. And gender roles often position men as a head of the household with authority. Mm-hmm. And women as caregivers whose primary duty is taking care of the kids and obedience to the man. This provides a kind of blueprint for abuse and an excuse for abusers. And all of this is sustained by pervasive culture of silence or 체면. That's a saving face.
Uh-huh.
The silence allows the community to ignore the severity of violence. The primary fear for the survivor is often not just the abuser, but the shame from their community that comes with the speaking up. So to receive services, a survivor has to break all these powerful rules at once.
Yeah. What about you guys, Lydia and Jeanette? What role does family and gender roles, and how does that play into a survivor reaching out for support?
I think in general, I hear often where sometimes it's a hit or miss. You know, sometimes families would be supportive and say, you know, it was time to reach out for help. Other times, family would pressure. Usually is the partner is the one, causing the harm that would pressure, threaten, you know, to not go to police, to not go to the authorities. And they even make it as if, you know, the one that caused the harm is being victimized by, in this case, the victim, because she's going to cause him, big consequences, hard consequences. And so I see that very often where in sessions, you know, women express, you know, even they say, I don't want to harm him. I didn't want to harm him, cause him any harm, you know, meaning that, you know, that they did not want them to suffer any legal consequences. They just wanted the abuse to stop. So, and sometimes even when they do, the families of the one that caused the harm would, you know, be very hostile, you know, threaten them and, you know, just use social media or use other family members to just harass the victim. When that is the case, it's very difficult because the victim feels isolated. You know, dealing with the aftermath mm-hmm. of, you know, involving the authorities and, you know, needing, when they, you know, the victim needs more, the most support. She feels ostracized and isolated.
I can imagine it's difficult too if you come from a country where some of these behaviors are not seen as illegal or crimes. And then you get here and they are crimes.
Mm-hmm.
How do we message that? How do we package that? Because you're not going to overnight say, well, you know what? I know it's a crime here. So I'm not going to have stigma. I'm not going to feel shame. I'm not going to care that he loses his job or goes to jail. Like, how do you address that?
That's a really hard thing to address. I have seen that with survivors who are from Arabic-speaking countries where the burden of proof is on the survivor to show that they've been abused. And a lot of time when survivors go to the police, they can come back and say, I forgave him, and then the case is dropped. Because the idea of preserving the family units and how like domestic violence or some kind of abuse happened in the home and someone deciding, I want to leave this relationship, it can cause a lot of shame for the whole family. It can ostracize the survivor. It depends on the victim is a male or a female. A lot of time when it's a male, they're not believed unless the abuse is very severe. For females, the burden of proof, of course, is on them to show. You have to bring witnesses that have seen the violence. You have to bring character witness. The burden of proof is on you. And that's why legally is very different between here and other countries. And we run into situation when we're talking about safety planning and survivors are expecting to call the police because that's their safety, thinking that I'm going to say I forgive him and the case is going to be dropped. And the case is not dropped because the person has caused harm to another person, whether there was evidence, domestic violence has a mandated arrest here in Virginia. So it's really hard when we start talking because we don't want to tell people don't call the police if you're unsafe because this is their livelihood. We're talking about the wives. We're talking about severe violence sometimes. If they need to talk to call the police, but we give them all aspects of what's going to happen. This is a decision I want you to make because I think this is good for your safety, but you know your safety best. What kind of other things you can do to stay safe where you are, if that's what you really need to do? Because a lot of survivors don't understand that we provide safety planning where they're in the relationship or outside of the relationship. We don't ask them to leave their home, but we want to make sure they're safe. And when we talk about different culture where people come in with different definition of domestic violence, even legal definition of domestic violence, and the different things that might happen if you call the police or seek legal remedies. Divorce is really, really easy in some Arab countries. Here, you have to wait up to a year before you're able to get divorced. So there is a lot of barriers that clients we see actually face when they are trying to seek legal remedies. And these things are not cheap. And they're not easy to pursue. And also because of the stigma behind domestic violence in a lot of immigrant communities, they don't have the support of their own community either. So it's easier for them to stay in their relationship. It's easier for them to, I want to say, quote unquote, like save themselves the shame of trying to fight this. So it's really complicated. And it's really, it's sometimes it helps having the same advocate or service provider who understand the topic, they understand the culture. But also there's another stigma, another level of that is some people are scared. Like if we're both in the same community and I know all these things about them, they're concerned about me going out and sharing this information with other people from my community. So it takes a lot of education to explain VAWA, how we are not able per the Violence Against Women Act to share information with other people. I can get fired from my position, our grant funding can be affected by that. So talking a lot about confidentiality, and it takes time to build that rapport, even among our own community. There's a lot of other barriers, but when we talk specifically about legal barriers, it's very, very hard for an immigrant survivor to go to the police because of a lot of misconceptions. A lot of information they have, it could be from where they're coming from or from what they hear around them.
Let's talk about language barriers as one of the barriers. I know we have Language Line and survivors, and you guys can make use of them. And the three of you do speak Arabic, Spanish, and Korean individually, not all together. But you're just three people. So obviously your work is crucial, but what challenges do you face because of language barriers? Do immigrants even know that we have advocates and counselors who speak their native tongue? Do they know that we provide services? Like, how are we getting this message out?
I think it would be important, depending on where, the culture, I think that some people congregate in certain areas because of their culture. For instance, I would say that using Latina supermarkets, churches, for instances, would be places to where we could, try to reach out to the community. Because you're right, Kendra, where sometimes I hear from clients say, I didn't know that these services existed, and I have been looking for this for years, and I have called here and there, and I didn't know that Fairfax had these services. So I think, if we're looking for areas or ways to get the word out, I think it would be, looking at where do Hispanics, congregate? Where do they like to go? And like I said, I feel, that Latino markets,
right,
churches, and, of course, schools would be a good way to spread the word that we have these wonderful services, for survivors and for those that cause harm.
Yes. The language barrier is a constant, the practical challenge.
Uh-huh.
So in Korean culture, so many first generation, the Korean immigrant survivors, their English proficiency is very low. So when they need kind of immediate help, they need to communicate quickly and accurately in Korean. But the relying on mainstream agencies' language lines can sometimes lack the culture nuance needed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the regarding awareness part, and many immigrants unfortunately do not know about all the free and confidential services available, like Dujina said. So I have experienced some ways to get the messages out, running advertisement in Korean, any language, but in Korean language newspapers and the radio shows, partnering with the Korean speaking churches and temples, and collaborating with Korean American social service agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's crucial for the community, and we have to go where the community already gathers.
Yes. I'm going to take a quick break here to remind our listeners that if any part of today's conversation triggers them, they can call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. I'm going to circle back to what we started talking about earlier and the cultural differences if you're from different parts of the world. Like, everybody who speaks Arabic is not from the same country. So how you respond to someone from Egypt, for instance, is different, or maybe different, from someone who's from Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia or some other Arabic-speaking country. How do you do that? How do you take that into consideration, especially if you're from one culture, mm-hmm, Lydia, you're from Egypt originally. So, like, your familiarity is with Egyptian Arabic speaking people. How would you manage, handle, help someone from Afghanistan who may have completely different cultural outlook on things?
So Arabic has many dialects, and some dialects are really hard to understand versus others.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when I meet a client or a survivor from a different culture than I am, even if we speak the same language, I come in with very low expectation that I understand where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm talking to someone from Syria who has been coming here as a refugee, have had all the trauma and based on what's happening, they've been displaced, I can't really relate because my experience is very different than their experience.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we speak the same language, and that might be a little bit facilitating the conversation between us, I have to ask more questions and be more open about not everyone coming from the same country has the same experience, let alone different countries with different experiences and different trauma. Could be mm-hmm. generational trauma, or it could be current trauma from current wars that happen in these countries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think even the language barrier among people who speak Arabic, it's really big. And even we've had situation where we're in court and requested a interpreter who speaks Arabic, that they speak a completely different Arabic than the completely different dialect than the client, the survivor, and they're trying to interpret what they're saying, but they're not able to because it's two different languages.
Mm-hmm.
We've requested before to change the interpreter with no hard feelings that have nothing to do with the interpreter. But if the client, one of the things that I start doing is because we're not allowed to interpret, especially in court or in official places, I ask the client, I ask the survivor, do you understand what this person is saying? Are you having a hard time understanding? Are they speaking a dialect that's really, really hard for you to understand?
Mm-hmm.
And then at least facilitate that part of it. But every country have their own, and we have many religions in the Middle East. So you cannot come in and kind of assume that someone is Muslim because they speak Arabic.
Uh-huh.
They might be Christian. They might be Doris. They might be in multiple. There's so many religions. So I can't really assume when I see clients. And it's really hard because survivors from who are Arabic speaking, they're used to be stereotyped. They're uh-huh. used to people looking at them and making assumptions based on how they speak, what they look like. And we have to take a step back and say, no, let's, can you educate me about where you're coming from? What are your needs? And how can I assist you? Whether what's happening now is because of what's happening to you now is, what is the need that you have right now? Whether mm-hmm. it's because of the trauma you've been through, is this triggering? Is this what you need? I don't know. I come in with it's pretty blank, because I can't really assume based on just the language. That is that's a very, very small part of the person that was coming to get services.
Right. Jeanette, you mentioned sometimes immigrants from Spanish-speaking countries, Spanish isn't even their first language. It might be an indigenous language.
Mm-hmm.
Do we even have translators for that?
It is difficult because I have heard requests for a specific dialect like Mam or any other. And sometimes, they speak Spanish, it's limited. So when working with them, if there is no interpreter available, but their Spanish is, pretty good. It's also important to be aware of that so that, we're speaking maybe slower, we're using words that are not too, complex, but, simpler language, and always checking back, do you, you know, does this make sense? Do you have any questions? Just checking back with them. And also the culture. Because sometimes it's, I think we all touched on the fact that, you know, for the most part, we have in our cultures are the male is the authority, is the, you know, the ruler of the home. So in this, I've noticed that this communities, indigenous communities, it's even more pronounced. Physical violence doesn't necessarily mean domestic violence. It's just, it is. And how do we, without, you know, making them feel like, oh, you know, your community is wrong. You know, how do we talk about domestic violence in the context that the survivor is at right now, and how, you know, it's impacting her life, and if there are kids, how is that impacting it? You know, the way that they feel, you know, their lives, etc. So taking it from there, I am not coming and say, you know, my way of thinking, you know, trying to avoid saying my way of thinking is the right way and this is the best way. But, you know, given, you know, your values, your belief, you know, how can we help you be safer, feel safe, and avoiding any harm to you? And then providing, you know, the options, but, you know, going back to the, it is an additional layer of, it could be challenging, but, you know, it would come with, you know, the desire to assist, the person that in front of us. I think it's very rewarding to see positive change in the person making plans to be safe.
So, Jen, you get a pass on this one because Korean speakers are from Korea. So, though I know there are different dialects.
But we can understand all dialects.
Right. So, how are we breaking some of these generational cycles of violence? You know, we have them here in the States, too. So, like, you can't solve the world's issues, but the specific generational cycles within the communities, the immigrant communities that you support. How are we breaking generational cycles? Are we? I listened recently to a podcast where a Spanish-speaking survivor said she wasn't even aware that what she was experiencing and had been experiencing for decades was domestic violence until her teenage children told her that what it was domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. I hear that very often.
Mm-hmm. The younger generation is truly the leading the charge and change. Thus, I think the second generation Korean Americans have not the Korean only the Korean American, all the second generation have a very different perspective on individual rights and healthy relationships. For example, we can see the scenarios where a child recognizes that their parent is enduring domestic violence, and sometimes they seek help for the parents by themselves because they learned about domestic violence in a U.S. health class. So they know what domestic violence is and how to address it. So they might be the ones to tell their parents, like, hey, mom or dad, this is not the normal. This is abuse. You need the help. So these younger members serve as kind of vital bridge for their parents. They can translate information, connect them to service, and provide that emotional support needed to break the silence. They challenge their traditional norms that kept their parents silent, and they can be powerful advocates for the change within their own homes, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I think school in that sense, I think helps to to educate the children, to give them a definition, or at least, you know, teaching about boundaries. Because that boundaries is something so powerful, and yet something that in many cultures are not really defined. We you know, we don't know what, you know, what healthy boundaries are, or boundaries at all. So the fact that, you know, children are learning about healthy boundaries, consent, these are concepts that, you know, parents, you know, our parents, you know, didn't really hear until they came here. And so I think that's powerful, where the kids are pointing out, and, you know, mom, that, you know, that's not right what that said. Or, you know, starting to set boundaries, or saying, you know, you should call the police, you know, when a situation seems to be escalating. And that, you know, and it's powerful because the kids are not thinking about all the consequences, you know, maybe losing, you know, financial stability, having to move. They're not thinking about that, but they're just, they know that what they're experiencing at that moment is not right. And they have been told, you know, when this happened, you know, you need to seek help. So call the authorities. Whereas the adult would say before, calling would be thinking about all the consequences, all the aspects that will, you know, affect them as a family, because usually, you know, the burden to keep that family, you know, together, and, you know, go when it falls on mom, on the woman. So, yeah, I think the new generations are helping, you know, start to talk about some concepts, like I said, you know, boundaries, such as boundaries, healthy boundaries, and consent, and what is acceptable, behaviors acceptable, and what is abuse.
What about male survivors from immigrant communities? How are we supporting them? Is how we support them different from how we would support male U.S. survivors? I know this is a completely different. Men in general don't come forward. They don't want to talk about this. They don't want to admit that this has happened to them. And this is from whatever culture they're from. But I can imagine if you're from a really, really male dominant community, that it would be really hard to come forward and seek services, ask for support, ask for resources. Do we even have any? I know we DSVS supports all genders, but how are we supporting the men in the communities that you help?
I feel like males reach out usually when that violence becomes very severe, to the point where they feel like, oh, I can now prove that there is, like, violence. And that comes from the stigma of, I'm a man, I should bear more. I'm a man, I don't get abused. Boys don't cry. These are all stigma that it's been engraved in a lot of survivors of domestic violence, and they don't identify it. And I feel like there's similarities, and there is a little bit of differences between male survivors who were raised, born and raised in a Western culture versus in the Middle East, of course. And it takes a lot of, I don't want to say convincing, but a lot of things that can happen for a male survivor to actually come in and ask for support and ask for services. And I feel like one of the things that we've tried to do a lot is to do a lot of education, especially with leaders, like faith-based leaders, or community centers, because the biggest part of how to connect survivor to services is word of mouth. Is saying, if you come to DSVS and you tell them I was a survivor, they're not going to question you. They're going to provide you with support. Or maybe just call them to see what services they provide. And that's something that we've been trying so hard to do, is to go into these communities and have presence and tell them we exist, and have faith-based leaders who already these survivors trust them and come to them for support. and have them make these referral directs to us. And we've had before faith-based leaders call us directly and ask, I have someone who's not ready, but what can you guys do? But it's really hard because there is a bigger stigma for male survivors than female survivors. And the way to get out is it feels like there's more barrier.
Okay. We could talk about this all day because I'm just fascinated. But we don't have all day. So I'm going to get a final takeaway from the three of you. What do you want the last message that our audience hears from you to be? And I want all three of you to respond to this. So Sujin, I'm going to start with you.
Okay. My main takeaway for our listeners is that the survivors in the immigrant community face very unique and a lot of barriers due to a complex interplay of cultural expectations, language barriers, and immigration status concerns. So truly, to support them effectively, we must approach our work with cultural humility and deep commitment to understanding their specific needs by the working hand-in-hand with the culturally specific organizations, empowering survivors with information about their rights, and the creating safe, confidential spaces. We can help them break the silence and find the safety. It is collective responsibility to support all members of our community, regardless of their background or where they come from.
Jeanette?
As a counselor, I would say that we're breaking, chipping away from the stigma of seeking services outside mm-hmm. of family. Uh-huh. A lot of people are saying, wow, I didn't know that counseling, you know, was like this. I am glad I don't feel judged. I feel very safe talking about what's, what I'm going through. I realize that it's not, it's not because I'm crazy, but, you know, so I think that slowly we're chipping away from that stigma. And as a counselor, again, I would want to say that, services are available, in a safe, welcoming, non-judgmental space. There are resources, there is information, there is help. No one has to go through a situation of abuse, domestic abuse or sexual abuse alone. There is help in the county. There is help. As you have mentioned it earlier, Kendra, if anybody is going through some situation, give us a call anytime, 703-360-7273.
Lydia, your final thoughts?
If you're a survivor, we are here. We don't judge. We are open and we're here to support you in however you need, just to keep you safe, whether it's in a relationship or if you're trying to leave a relationship that you feel like it's abusive, we are here for you. And if you're a provider, like one thing that Sujin said perfectly is cultural humility. Don't assume that you know everything because you visited one country. Or if you see someone who speaks Arabic, that doesn't mean that every single client who speaks Arabic have had the same experiences or same trauma. Everyone is very different. And even people who live in the same household, they might have completely different experiences in the environment they're in. So just adopt cultural humility and just listen. Just ask questions and listen and don't make assumptions based on what you already know.
I will add that DSVS's services are anonymous, confidential, mostly free, and are provided regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, religion, immigration status, and sexual orientation. That'll do it for this episode of Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Lydia, Sujin, and Jeanette for joining us and sharing their expertise. If you or someone you know has experienced interpersonal violence, call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. That's 703-360-7273. Or visit fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. To listen to other Fairfax County government podcasts, visit www.fairfaxcounty.gov/podcasts. Unscripted, conversations about sexual and domestic violence, is produced by the Fairfax County, Virginia government.